What'd they say?
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Today we are diving straight into the Delphi case, part of the Delphi case that's been hiding in plain sight for years, hiding if you want to call it that, the depositions, the filings, the sworn testimony, and the internal investigative record that was never part of the polished public narrative. And I'm going to say this bluntly because there's no other way to say it. The picture these depositions paint is not one of a cohesive investigation that followed the evidence. It's the picture of an investigation fighting itself, contradicting itself, and stumbling through major decisions as if no one was steering the helm. We're not talking about minor mistakes. We're talking about the FBI possibly being kicked out or not, depending on which investigator you ask. We're talking about the Behavioral Analysis Unit setting up a flare about Nordic beliefs, ritualistic staging, symbolic indicators, only for the entire assessment to vanish from the internal record. We're talking about witness statements reshaped into something unrecognizable. When they hit the search warrant affidavit, we're talking about major leads in this case on possible third-party suspects just brushed aside with no further action. Even after bizarre self-incriminating statements, we're talking about sticks left at the crime scene for days, a bullet with zero field documentation, and experts brought in 7 years too late to analyze photographs instead of evidence. This isn't fringe speculation. These aren't internet fantasies. This is what investigators themselves said under oath in black and white. And the only question now is what any of this means for Richard Allen, for the appeal, and for the integrity of the case itself. Here to help us dissect all of this, Bob Mata, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. Bob, let's dive into this shit show as it continues along. The shit tracks. Two lead investigators, two opposite sworn statements about whether the FBI was removed from the case. One says they were kicked out. The other says, I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, just take us into this cesspool of confusion.
Yeah, so what we're talking about in terms of the new evidence, if you out there in the audience aren't aware, during the case itself, actually pre-trial, but before any hearings were conducted, there was this thing called a Franks motion that was filed by the defense, and the Franks motion is essentially saying, in layperson's terms, that when they went in to get the warrant, the arrest warrant and or the search warrant, that there were misrepresentations or omissions that were made or straight up lies that were made by law enforcement in order to secure that particular warrant. Okay, so the defense filed it. It's a massive filing. It was like 136 pages. And with that, there was a ton of exhibits that were attached. Okay. So once that thing was resolved, if you want to call it that, even though there was never actually a hearing on it, but she did have a hearing on the third party culprit stuff, which is kind of where the Franks memo lived in terms of the information that it put out to the public. Ultimately, what ends up happening is that Allen's convicted and there's an appeal being processed right now. They're preparing the appellate briefs. And Allen's appellate lawyers are saying, look, we don't have the exhibits for this huge Franks memo. We need them. Because for whatever reason, the clerk, Jody Williams, who happens to be Judge Gull's clerk, didn't supply those exhibits along with the record when she prepared it for the appeal. Okay. So the defense appellate attorneys go and say, hey, we need these, you need these. We need them to prepare the brief, and you, the appellate court, need them so that you have a complete record in front of you. And at that point, the appellate court turns around and says, okay, here's the deal. We've been asking you to get the record complete so that we can move along with this appeal. and they gave Williams and Gall 20 days to get the thing on record. Okay. Mm-hmm. Make to perfect the appellate record. So that's what dropped. So they're not new in the sense like it's unearthed evidence that came out of nowhere. It's the evidence, as the defense sees it, that was attached as exhibits to the Franks memo. However, mm-hmm. in terms of us seeing it, the public, it's yeah. all new. So yes. we didn't see all this stuff. So we're kind of getting a peek behind the curtain. We're kind of getting a vision of what the defense was seeing when they started digging into things. And, you know, I mean, there's just a lot of shocking stuff out there. And starting with kind of your first point, Tony, with, you know, why were the feds disposed of in this case? And I'll tell you, Doug Carter got on the stand and, I mean, he testified to it at trial that he told the FBI, no, we're good. Thanks, but no thanks.
Can you just turn them away like that? Can you just go, get lost, buddy. It's not your jurisdiction.
Yeah, I mean, apparently, because he did. You know, they dipped out of the case.
Why would you?
Manpower, you know.
Why would you? And how common is that to have happen, especially when you're talking about, and maybe it's more common than I'm aware of, when we're talking a smaller jurisdiction here like Duffy, they don't have a lot of resources. So the FBI being like, hey, we're going to help you. We can really dig in here. We can give you these resources that you don't have. How common is it that small jurisdictions turn that sort of thing away? Maybe it is for the wrong reasons, which I feel like it is here. And I just, why did they do that in this case?
Well, I mean, it's kind of like that question of why does it seem like they're protecting a pedophile in Spencer? I mean, there is no good answer. And the only answer that you can come up with is nefarious.
Yeah.
Like you're talking about the Unified Command, which is this little, you know, kind of internal investigation team that they put together, which was comprised of a bunch of guys that had never investigated anything like this. Mm-hmm. Like nothing. Like
the title, Unified Command.
Unified Command. Command. Yeah.
Yeah.
So ultimately they end
Unified.
Up.
Unified.
Thanks, Todd.
That's me.
Oh, thanks, Tone. Ultimately, why they did it is inexplicable. I mean, you're talking about the feds, who are obviously going to have way more experience. They're going to have way more resources. They're going to have way better technology. Mm-hmm. Like, why you wouldn't want them involved if they're willing to do it is inexplicable to me. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is deeper into the investigation. I think it's in like 2019. It's like 2 years yeah. in, you know, so I wish I had a better answer. I simply don't know. And I cannot think of a good reason as to why. You know, it's like you're talking about these guys. I don't want to call them a bunch of Barney Fifes, but to me, from the outside looking in, they look like a bunch of Barney Fifes.
I was just going to ask about that, because are all cases as confusing and jumbled behind the scenes? And maybe we just don't see it. And when it all comes out into trial, it is a nice, neat package. Are they this disorganized behind the scenes all the time, or is this a extraordinary case?
No, well, I think that, you know, you're dealing with human beings, and human right. beings make mistakes, and you know, you're going to have cops when you've got multiple, especially if there's multiple agencies involved. You know, you're going to have individuals that are have their own thoughts on the case. They're going to have ideas that the investigation should go one way, and another guy's going to say, well, I don't think that's it. And if that guy ranks higher than the guy who thinks it should go one way, that guy who's the lower ranking guy, his theory of the way the investigation should go is not going to be adhered to, and it's not going to be taken seriously, which is exactly what happened here. I happen to be friends with one of the guys who was originally on this case as an investigator with the Carroll County Sheriff's Department, and he was a high ranking deputy sheriff in there. And, you know, he was a guy who had said, look, I think this is like we're over our skis on this one. Like we need help. We need help from qualified agencies that have done this type of investigation before, because we're going to fuck it up. And ultimately, he ends up leaving the sheriff's department, whether it was by hook or by crook is hard to know. He ended up suing, and I think there was a settlement, but you know, he was very much of the mindset that they needed help because they just could not do this because they weren't equipped and they didn't have the experience to do it. So in that case, you know, I mean,
that's a big piece of this. Like right at the beginning, you have that sort of behavior going on. You have someone saying exactly what you just said. We're in over our heads on this. We need a little bit of help. Well, we don't. And however that went down, it ends in a lawsuit and he leaves. Obviously, it probably had something to do with this. At least that would be the tea leaves if we're going to read them, in my opinion. So you have this already. We see this track record of are these blinders that these guys had on in this case? Because this is the thing that we always look at in here. And now that we're seeing some of these depositions and such, we're always trying to figure out, is it incompetence or is there something trying to be covered up here? Because the two can look very, very similar. Incompetence quite often can look very nefarious, but sometimes people are just not the brightest or right. They're just not that experienced. They don't have reps in a certain area and what they may think they should do turns out to be probably the worst idea imaginable. When you started looking at some of these depositions, Bob, what was your takeaway? What were some of the key pieces that had stood out to you?
I mean, really, Jerry Holman's was probably the most disturbing, you know, and Jerry Holman was really the lead dude on this thing. You know, I mean, if anybody's watched any of the Allen interrogations, and there's two of them, you know, it's Jerry Holman that's the cop who's interrogating him in the second one, which is, you know, the more disturbing of the two. And that is ultimately where, you know, Rick Allen, after that interview, never saw the light of day again. You know, he was taken into custody and he never left that police department. When they were told to come over to that police department under the guise that they were coming to pick up their car that they had taken to, you know, process. So, you know, he ends up going there. But, you know, the Holman thing to me is just unbelievable.
What, you know, because, go into that for those who haven't seen the deposition. Just give us your synopsis of it.
I mean, to me, you're hearing from a cop who's essentially, in a nutshell, Tony, talking out of both sides of his mouth. You know, and it's, you know, because they're asking him specific questions, and I think Baldwin was the one doing the questioning, but it could have been Rosie. I can't remember at this point, but. You know, it's just like they're really kind of diving into the investigation. And what becomes apparent throughout this deposition is that they really had no idea. You know, they initially and for a long, long time, they believed that this was multiple people had committed this crime and then they didn't. And, you know, in terms of the questioning about the third party culprit stuff, you know, it's just, you know, it's hard to pinpoint one thing without having it in front of me. Yeah. But it, like the whole thing, just the way that it reads, you really get an idea that, you know, they really did nail a square peg into a round hole in terms of Richard Allen in this case. You know, once they landed on him as the guy, you know, and once they decided, okay, well, he put himself out there and, you know, we got this unspent casing that we think that we'll be able to go into court and say matches his weapon. That's as good as it's going to get for us. You know what I'm saying? And I mean, that's how this thing felt all along to me, you know, and when we start getting into the exhibits with this Franks thing, And I'm sure we're going to talk about it more, but when you look at the things that three very qualified cops, longtime cops that continue to investigate, and we're talking about Ferency, Click, and Murphy, the guys who were continuing kind of on the Norse paganism type theme that this, you know, was something that was going on. And you look at what the evidence that they developed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for Holman and his depth to be saying, well, you know, Holder had an alibi. He has an alibi for a time frame that you're claiming that you think this time the crimes took place. You know, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like the kidnapping of the girls could have taken place at one time and the homicides could have taken place at any time prior to when they're discovered the next day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for them to be acting as if it all happened contemporaneously, they're kidnapped. As soon as they get down there, they cross this river. They're all soaking wet. It's, you know, 3.5 feet high. You know, Alan, who's, you know, 5'4", 5'5", would be, you know, up to his high chest, somehow controlling two girls. He gets over there and then kills them both. That all happens kind of like one thing after another. Doesn't seem to make much sense to me.
No, I mean, it's almost like if it were to be, you know, you watch like a situation comedy and sometimes they get the piano music moving and then it turns into this very, you know, funny physical comedy routine that goes on for, you know, an extended period of time. You're like that's all. I mean, this is a horrible situation, but that's almost what you'd be talking about is just like, oh, and this happened. And then it's like all improv to work this certain way and it's going to do this. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
it just doesn't make any sort of logical sense. What's your take here? Because the thing that was talked about early on, and then obviously it never got it into the trial, is the Odinism. And when we first heard about it way back, I remember it. We're like, what the hell? Huh? Is this real? But this is actually something the FBI's behavioral analysis unit brought into the picture we're learning about. The behavioral analysis isn't just like kind of like, well, let's spin the magic eight ball. Let's see here. Odinism today is what we got. Looks like, kids, it might be Odinism. No, I mean, they looked into this. They found experts to talk to. There's actually quite a bit, as crazy as this shit sounds. There's quite a bit of evidence that points to at least somebody or some peoples are into this over there. No, it may not be quite eyes wide shut level shit, but somebody likes to do some of this stuff in some way, shape, or form, and they're practicing it in some way, shapes, or forms. At least that's what it appears.
Yeah, it, without question. And, you know, if you were able to go back in a time machine, if you're the defense, in terms of making sure that the wording was more carefully put out to the public in terms of what they thought might have occurred here. Mm-hmm. I think that when they kind of worded that it was a ritual sacrifice, that was a thing that I think made people go to the place like, okay, well, that's fucking crazy.
You went to like satanic panic.
Right, know? Right, because yeah. it didn't have to be that. And I don't think that it was that. I think it's exactly what you said, that you may have had a couple, two, three guys that were into this kind of shit, and that for whatever reason the homicides took place, that it wasn't because of a sacrifice to the gods, mm-hmm. but that it, you know, whatever it was, whatever the true motive was, and that part of their belief system is what accounts for the fact that they left these sticks in this, you know, in these particular arrangements, you know what I'm saying? So mm-hmm. it's a whole different thing to think that they went out there and, you know, with the express intent goal of finding two girls and, you know, they're going to sacrifice them for a specific religious purpose. Whereas whatever may have happened here, whatever, mm-hmm. whatever the true motive was, you know, that they're basically just going out there. And then once the deed was done, in terms of what kind of their belief system is, that they mm-hmm. decide, okay, well, you know, maybe we feel bad about it. Maybe, you know, we're whatever the case may be, whatever their thought process is, which is really why the defense's expert Perlmutter, who didn't get to testify at trial, was really fascinating, because cops, and one of the things that she was explaining is that cops are not taught to investigate in kind of, you know, with a magical thought process. And I know that that's kind of a corny sounding thing, but magical thought is like in real world application. If you pray, you know, to
magical thinking.
Yeah, magical thinking. And you pray and you're hoping that prayer is going to come true. Mm-hmm. That's magical thought. So it's not necessarily magic like wizards and shit. Right. It's just thinking that something out there. So, you know, and everybody has their own conception of what that is personally. You know what I'm saying? So, but cops aren't trained to think in that way in terms of when they're looking at a crime scene. So when they brought the BAU in, they're looking at it and they're like, okay, this is unusual, which was enough for them to think, okay, yeah, this does have some elements of what appears to be Norse paganism. You know, like there's some Odinism type, you know, like the runes, what appear to be runes are clearly something that we think that this could be a part of it. I mean, if you watched the first season of True Detective, I mean, which I think was out right around the same fucking time. Like, you know, it had that kind of vibe to it.
Yeah.
You know, so ultimately I'm going to trust the BAU more than I'm going to trust Unified Command in terms of what their initial assessment was.
Yeah. Unified Command.
So, you know, again, everything goes back to why are they kicking the feds out of the party? You know, it always goes back to that question for me. And, you know, there's the entire thing with the Purdue professor, Turco, which, you know, again, if you follow the case, you're aware that when the defense uncovered all these different things that were stuck randomly in the 15 terabytes of discovery, you know, so as to hide them, like they weren't in one cohesive package, like, oh, here's the Odinism stuff. All in one nice, neat package. It was all stuck around like needles in a haystack. Mm-hmm. So when they end up uncovering these things piecemeal and they start looking at it and they're like, holy shit, what is going on here? And like, why did this thing go away? Why did this leg of the investigation dry up? You know, and ultimately you can't help but wonder exactly why that took place. Because when They then go, because initially Unified Command's like, okay, there is something weird about this scene. So they go to this Purdue professor, who this is his field, and they say, okay, here's the crime scene photos, man. Like, did you notice anything strange about this? And he's like, well, it certainly seems to have, you know, some telltale signs of what looks to be some kind of Norse paganism ideology going on. He's like, I'm certainly going to, I'm not going to say that it doesn't. So you've got this Purdue professor who they then, when they decide that they're going to take a different path, okay, they disappear that guy, at least in terms of him being any part of the investigation or that they consulted with them. So when the defense is asking, hey, who was this Purdue professor that you went to? And that's the whole thing where they're playing the game. Oh, we don't know. We forget what his name was. Like the whole thing. And then ultimately there's emails going back between Baldwin, who's one of the defense attorneys, and McClelland, who's the prosecutor. And McClelland's telling him, oh, yeah, you know, I asked those guys. And you know, they're kind of the mindset that we'll never be able to figure it out who this guy was. And, you know, so ultimately the defense keeps pressuring them on this point. And look, dude, like there's not going to be that many people at Purdue that are professors that are in that department that are going to be teaching this kind of shit. They were going to figure out who the fuck it was.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, like the defense investigator would eventually have gone over there and said, okay, which one of you guys talked to Unified Command? which one of you guys talked to the, you know, the Carroll County Sheriff's Department? Like who, you know, and out of the three people in that department, one of them said, oh yeah, it was me. So like ultimately, you know, McClelland's still sending out emails saying that they're not going to know. And then the interim, they end up finding out through Holman's deposition that they knew who it was and they had told McClelland. So
surprise.
It's like, like the kind of shit that was going on is all the thing that happens, like all the things that happen that make you doubt this conviction so vehemently. You know, I mean, for me, at least.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.